to the Deco Retro program here on Planet FM. We will bring you interesting interviews, updates of future Deco, Modern, Retro, and other related events. Also the stories that celebrate New Zealand's history and its people, as well as book reviews and other snippets capturing the glamour and fascination of a bygone era.
Deco Retro, Deco Retro.
Good afternoon, listeners. This is Nancy on the Deco Retro program. Today we are interviewing Andrea Calland. Andrea was born in Taumarunui in 1953. She lived in Wellington for the first 4 years of her life, but at the age of six, she went to school in Auckland, attending Carmel College in her secondary years. At 11 years of age, she saw Marcel Marseille at Her Majesty's Theatre and was so influenced by him, she decided she wanted to become a mime artist. 16 finds her back in Taumarunui, working at the local repertory theatre, and here her germ of love of performing began. Back in Auckland, aged 18, working as box lady at the Mercury Theatre, she was discovered by Raymond Hawthorne, who had just returned to New Zealand from NIDA in London. Age 23 finds her in Sydney working in street theatre, cabaret and Q Theatre. Finally, she was accepted by Leacock Mime School in Paris. Later back in London, she married, and finding herself pregnant in 1981, she returned back to New Zealand to be near her family. Her husband joined her, and with baby Tim, they both toured with the Mercury Theatre in the show Once a Catholic. The marriage did not survive, and Andrea, as a solo mum, pursued her career as an actor, producer, and writer. For the last 15 years, she has been a casting director with Shortland Street. She retired in April of this year during lockdown. Her son, Tim, lives and works overseas on super yachts. Good morning, Andrea. Lovely to have you on the show today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Nancy.
Now, you were first influenced many long years ago when you were a child by Marcel Marceau. Can you tell us a little bit about that, your meeting up with him and how you felt?
Oh, well, I didn't actually meet him. I just went to a show at His Majesty's Theatre when I was about 11.
Oh, okay.
And I did try to go backstage, but, you know, there was thousands of other people wanting to, so I didn't actually meet him. I'm sorry I gave you that impression.
Oh, no, that's okay.
Watching him perform.
Yes.
And I'd never seen mime before, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it was a real eye-opening experience. And as a little girl, I'd done ballet, and I recognised that, you know, it was a very graceful art form, and I decided that's what I wanted to be.
Yes. No, that sounds really interesting. Are there any great mime artists around today, or have they all disappeared?
Well, no, there are many. There are many mime artists around because there are mime schools that that train them up, and if you ever go to Europe, you'll see mime artists on just about every street corner in Paris. And Berlin and places like that, but as an art form, as something that would hold an audience for a whole two-hour show, I think Marcel Marceau was sort of the be-all and end-all in terms of being a one-man performing mime artist.
Right. No, he was very famous. I sort of remember him vaguely myself, although I didn't really see any of his shows. You actually applied for an arts degree to go to Leacock Mime School in Paris, didn't you? But you couldn't quite get in there
Well, it was one of those situations. When I was in New Zealand, I applied to go, and they said, well, we can't give you money to go until we know that you're actually, you know, accepted onto the program. So,
oh, okay.
And then the second time I applied, I had actually been accepted into the program, and they said, oh, I'm sorry, you can't get the grant because you're not actually living in New Zealand at the moment. So it was one of those
How disappointing.
Damned if you don't.
Yes, oh, that would have been a great disappointment to you.
I was, yeah, at the time, yeah.
Yeah, so being so disappointed, you decided, right, you'd do your big OE and headed for Sydney. Well, you intend to go all around the world, but Sydney came on your list first. What did you do there, Andrea? What were you involved in Sydney in the way of...
I worked at the box office in the Nimrod Theatre, which is one of Sydney's big theatres there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a job out at the Q Theatre in Penrith, and that was a sort of a smallish regional theatre, but they did pay their actors, so that was...
Well, that was
nice
good. Makes a difference. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I had been a paid actor back in New Zealand. I worked at Theatre Corporate and... under Raymond Hawthorne, and I was one of their founder members. So I already had sort of 4 years of professional theatre under my belt. So I had a bit of a CV when I got to Sydney.
Yes.
Which was handy, you know. So I got that work there. And then I met up with a couple of New Zealanders, and we started doing street theatre.
Oh, that would be interesting. So this is just performing on street corners or...
Well, you know. We got employed by the markets. There was Market and Paddington Market.
Yes.
To kind of, you know, kind of bring something in. And a lot of our material was suitable for children. So
people
would kind of bring their kids and sit them round us and go off and do their shopping and leave the kids there, and we'd be kind of, you know, unpaid babysitters.
Yes.
But, we got to be quite popular and we got a bit of a following. And then in the evenings, we also did a bit more raunchy cabaret for grown-ups, which was...
Oh, okay. Well, that sounds interesting.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you felt, you learnt quite a lot there in Sydney. There's probably a lot more going on there than what there was in New Zealand in those days.
At that time, yeah.
Now, okay, so you finally got accepted at the mime school, the Leacock Mime School in Paris. Can you tell us a little bit about your life there? I mean, that would have been really exciting, I would think. And
it was wonderful to kind of actually finally get there. I was 26 by then, so I'd been wanting to be a mime artist for 15 years already.
Yes.
So to sort of walk in the doors and kind of be doing kind of mime exercises and being taught by some of the best teachers in the world for that time.
I imagine.
And it was a really international school, so there were kids there from South America, all over Europe, Russia.
Okay.
Amsterdam. I think at that one stage they counted up and that there was 120 students from like 73 different countries. So,
that's amazing.
They had more international students than they had actual French students. So,
yes.
It was a very kind of a lively environment. So they take on quite a lot of people for the first term.
Yes.
And then they do a cull. And
on
the second term, they bring the number down to 30 for the second part of the thing.
Mm.
And I actually got culled.
Well, that was a shame.
Round.
Yeah.
It was very sad. I was very... one of the things that, my French wasn't great. It was still...
Okay.
I had schoolgirl French. I could ask for what I wanted, but in any form of theatre, you've got to be able to talk about your feelings.
Yes, of course.
So
yes.
Many thousands of words for feelings, and, you know, all I could come up with, triste for sad and joyeux for happy, and they were very strict about only speaking French, so that meant, you know, all the kids from, say, Brazil and other languages, we all had to struggle along on how
on trying to learn your French.
French at the same time.
Yeah, it's a bit unfair that it was, well, I suppose it is in Paris, so that's going to be the...
Paris, yeah.
What can you do about that? Not much.
Well, I should have done a few more classes and, and concentrated a bit more on my French, I think, before I got there.
But you would have got, quite a lot out of that first term, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. I can still rustle up a wall and I do the mime walk and,
yes.
The real basics I can
basics. works, well, yeah, which
know.
Is good.
And I can do enough to kind of parody it, you know, to make people laugh, but because they can see what I'm doing and, you know, use it for comedy. So, you know, comedy is my... The string to my thing that I've taken from that.
Now, after that, you returned to London and you married your long-term boyfriend. And you were involved in acting there. So London would have been a very exciting place in those days to sort of further your career or get involved there.
Yes, it was pretty... it was this, you know, the 80s, the early 80s, so... You know, there were all the was punk and...
The
New Romantics.
Yes.
So they were sort of... And I actually, one of the jobs that I got to do was to open up a little nightclub under a bar in Knightsbridge. And that's where all the New Romantics used to come and dance. And all these, you know, the Sloanies, the very wealthy kind of people that lived around Knightsbridge in that area used to come to my... Well, it wasn't mine, but I ran it for a
while. You ran it.
So that was really exciting.
That would have been a real experience, I should imagine.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I can still rustle up quite a good cocktail when required.
All right, I'll keep that in mind. Now, in 1981, you discovered you were pregnant and returned to New Zealand. And as you were finding it hard to make ends meet. So you came back to, you know, and got quite a lot of support from your family, and your husband joined you soon afterwards. So after Tim, which is your son, was born, did you pursue your acting career or, you know?
Yeah, really. I mean, I was really lucky because when he was about 6 weeks old, I got a role at the Mercury. We're doing a touring production of Once Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen, my husband, was working there as a stage manager. And I was, you know, I was 29 by then, but I still, you know, I still had my youthful looks. So I got cast as a schoolgirl.
Yes. So there's
three schoolgirls and three nuns, and basically it was a comedy about going to Catholic schools and how naughty Catholic schoolgirls are. And
well, you had been to Carmel.
My character was, and I went to Carmel College.
So yes.
I had a little bit of research under my belt.
Exactly.
So we toured that round the country. For about 3 or 4 months, and I was allowed to take Timothy with me. He was just a little baby.
Oh, my gosh. That would have been quite hard with a little baby,
well,
I'm sure.
He was the best baby because we'd go to the theatre, and I put him down at 7 o'clock in the dressing room, and because it was a kind of a play where it was either all of the nuns were on together or all of the schoolgirls were on together.
Oh, okay.
So there was always somebody in the dressing room to kind of keep an eye on Timothy. Apart from a few minutes during the curtain call, so
yes,
he was alone.
Oh, well, that's good. At that time, was there any funding for live theatre? I mean, you probably weren't paid that well, and you'd have been...
Well, we did get paid with the Mercury, and we got put up in hotels and around in the bus, so that was pretty amazing. But after that, it was back to doing community theatre, and luckily, around about, I can't remember what year exactly, the Labor government got in and they put up these PEP schemes, which were basically a living wage for artists.
Gosh.
And, so I got a role on there as an actor, and friends of mine got roles as writers, and there were people who were allowed to be painters and set designers. And so it was a very great time to be
Yeah, good on the Labor government for supporting you a bit, yes.
Yeah, so out of that, we came to the attention of the unions, and they were, by 91, they were struggling to keep hold of their membership because, I don't know whether you remember, that was about when
yes.
the Employment Contracts Act came in and they were going to ban compulsory unionism.
I know. I do remember that, being forced into, you know, you really had to join the union.
This was just after that where you no longer had to join the union.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So, of course, the union, you know, they were on the precipice of, you know, bankruptcy or, you know, mm-hmm. and they were losing their members, because for some people, whatever the union fee was, it might have only been $30 a year, but, you know, that's $30 worth of smokes or $30 worth of beers or, you know, $30 worth
exactly.
of children's clothing. People were dropping like flies out of the union. So they sent us round to the union's tea breaks where they'd have a little union meeting and we'd come out and do some comedy and talk about, you know, how awful it would be if they didn't have a union. And we, so they were just little 5-minute skits, but they kind of, you know, they summed up, you
the
know,
feeling.
If you don't have a union, you know, you're going to be down the girdler and nobody will protect your wages or your conditions. So they were interesting times.
Yes, I'm sure. Now, unfortunately, Andrea, your marriage did not survive, so you found yourself on your own with Tim. And so that must have been pretty hard years for you, sort of financially, being a solo mum. Can you...
Yeah.
How did you...
Well, I was on the DPB, which, you know, is government, and then every now and then I would get a little commercial maybe, you know, that would pay quite well and kind of, you know, tied me over. Every now and then I'd get a small role in a movie or all through those years we were starting to make some movies here in New Zealand.
That's right, and some good ones too, weren't they?
Yeah. Some End of the Golden Weather and
a
few others.
Yes.
So, we never starved, let's put it that way. You know, if the work ran out, I could go back on the DPB. But then in about 1996, I sort of got sick of living on the smell of an oily rag.
I'm sure.
13 by then, and I started to work my first sort of full-time real job with a casting director called Simon Marler at Central Casting.
Oh, yes.
And I was a casting assistant, and I read against the actors, and it was kind of like acting all day long, really. Quite fun. And I got paid more than a living wage, you know.
Really?
It was at the time, and that was really exciting. And then Simon got a big job to go down south to work on a movie called Vertical Limits, which was shot in Queenstown. And so he left me. I'd only been with him for about 6 months, and he left me running the Auckland division.
Oh, wow.
So very quickly, I had to get very good at...
So a lot of experience.
Yes. So I was just doing the commercials, but that's all about, you know, quantity rather than quality. You just get a whole lot of people in.
Yes.
For a particular role that look, you know, obviously... Very
How do you obtain those people? Do you advertise or what do you do?
Well, there are agents. And agents
have
tables of actors on their books. And
right.
So basically you write to them and say, look, I'm looking for a very attractive 35-year-old woman who looks like a lawyer. And they'll send you 200 people who all look like that. And you've got to pluck
on
those which ones you like the best. And then you put them down on tape,
That must be so interesting, sort of, you know, finding those people.
It's a fun job, yeah. It's really, really great when you get it right.
Yes, I'm sure. So you did that for quite a few years, many years, didn't you? And then you obtained a job on the Shortland Street series. Is that right? Yes.
Yes, that's right. 15 years ago, so 2005.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I came into Shortland Street to look after the casting department while Marianne Willison, who'd been there since the very beginning, she went home to England for 3 months in 2005. And so she trained me up to take over for her for that three-month period. And then she came back and then the next year she did it again in 2006. But that year she had a rather unfortunate accident on a double-decker bus. And she hurt her leg while she was in England. And she couldn't come back immediately. So I stayed on in the job for longer than the 3 months. And then by the end of the year, it was pretty obvious that she wasn't going to be well enough at that time to take over, so I got her job.
Oh, well, bad for her, but good for you. I mean, great.
Yeah, she was nearly up to retirement age anyway, but...
Oh, was she? Okay.
Not quite ready to leave. But anyway, lucky for me, and I'm so grateful to Marianne for everything she taught me.
Yes.
Very inspiring. So, yeah, I've been doing that job for 15 years, and that's such an amazing job, you know, in terms of if you love actors, which I do, and, you know, finally getting an actor who's been coming for 4 or 5 auditions and you finally get them a role that they're really good for, and there are those wonderful moments.
Yes, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, it's a great series. I mean, how long has it been going? I'm calling it a series because I suppose that's the right word to call it. They've been going for years, haven't they? And they're still 29 going.
29 years. 29 years this year.
But like
yeah.
the Coronation Street of New Zealand.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh no, great. And I believe they're wonderful to work for. You know, you have obviously had a very secure job there. You were well looked after and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Mm.
That's right, yeah.
No, that's great. Now, what are we going to talk about? You know, so you've been involved in films, TV and theatre here. Can you... what films have you been in?
End of the Golden Weather was the first New Zealand film that I ever did, and that was directed by Ian Mune, and that was
he's very famous.
Shot up north.
Okay.
That was a really wonderful experience, and the characters of that were almost like theatrical characters in the End of the Golden Weather, and I played one of the sisters. There was a fat sister and a skinny sister, and I played the skinny sister. And we just sort of basically played silly buggers on the beach for 4 weeks.
Sounds good, but
we worked hard. But over the years, I've got my CV right in front of me, but
it's probably hard to. I think I've got some here. The Insatiable Moon. I remember going to see that. I thought that was a wonderful movie.
Oh, yes, that was really lovely. Yeah, that was also about very eccentric
It was.
People.
Yes,
yeah.
Very.
I'm what they call a character actor, you see, so I always get the sort of left of... I never get the pretty ingenue, which is great, really.
Well, never mind.
People out there are listening. The pretty ingenues, they have a shelf life. You know?
I was just going to say, they only last for a while, that prettiness, doesn't it?
But, there are still some beautiful older actors. And all of that, like, I just aspire to them.
Mm.
As a character actor, you usually get quite a lot of very interesting work.
Yes, and a lot more roles, I imagine. Is there character acting? Yes.
There does seem to be, although, you know, it's pretty thin on the ground, you know, in your 60s, as I am. you know, stories are still usually about people a bit younger, you know.
Sure.
20s.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are lots of grandmas out there, but I can say... I get a lot of grandmas, I get a lot of headmistresses, educated, because I suppose about the way I talk, I get sort of educated lawyers and judges and vicars and priests and things like that. I still do acting, and it was great while I worked at Shortland Street. They would give me time off to go and pursue my acting career. And I was also the headmistress on Shortland Street.
Oh, okay.
From 2002 onwards. So even before I went to work as a casting director, I had an ongoing
role
that, you know, they wheeled out when the children were naughty, which was kind of... couple of times a year.
There you were, the school teacher. Now, you have retired, but I know, but you seem far too lively to do that, Andrea. So I'm sure you've got some plans for your future. You're not just going to retire.
No, I'm not going to just sit here and twiddle my thumbs. I've got a short film. I've been going to writing classes for the last 3 or 4 years. Out of that has come a short 1-hour play called Random Shagger.
Oh, which sounds exciting.
In 2018. And just one of the excerpts from that I'm going to turn into a short film, hopefully making it at the end of the year. Hopefully I'll be more successful in getting a bit of funding from the Arts Council this
right.
time around. and hopefully make that in September. So and there's sort of short films are there's whole festivals are all over the world on short films. So,
right. So you've really got plenty there to keep you interested and active for many long years, I imagine.
I hope so, yes.
Well, Andrea, it's been lovely having you with us today. I'm sure our listeners would really have enjoyed it. And unfortunately, we've run out of time. I'd like to go on a lot longer, but that's it. So thank you for being on the show.
Deco Retro Future Events.
Club Moderne wish to announce that, well, I think most people know that the winter deco is has been cancelled due to COVID-19, but there will be a luncheon at Mr. D's, 47 Tennyson Street, Napier, on Saturday the 18th of July at 12 o'clock. This is a chance to catch up and talk about plans for the weekend and admire each other's outfits. For more information, please contact Neil Warrington, and his email is nwarren, that's nwarrin at extra.co.nz. Now we have some music which Andrea has chosen today, and it's called Anchor Me, and it's written by the Mutton Birds, and the lead singer is Don McGlashan, and I believe it's about his wife. So listeners, I'd like to say goodbye for today, and I hope you've enjoyed the program.
Songs that come from dead men's tongues, anchor me, anchor me.
As the compass turns and the glass it falls and the storm clouds roll and the gulls they call, anchor me, anchor me, anchor me, anchor me. In the middle of your deep blue sea, anchor me, anchor me.
Crash and the whirlpool spins.